Hey, hey, it's Friday, and this is Pam, your host. We're on Authors on the Air live from the Primetime Studio. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm glad you're with us tonight. A really cool guest tonight, Todd Robinson, has been writing noir crime fiction particularly for quite a while now. He is the creator and was the chief editor of the multi-award-winning crime fiction magazine called Thuglit, who he finally decided to put to bed so he could concentrate on other endeavors. You can still buy his issues of Thuglit, though, in the Zon. So go there and look them up. They're really, really good stuff. His writing has appeared, though, in Blood and Tacos, Plots with Guns, Needle Magazine, Shotgun Honey, Strange, Weird, and Wonderful, Out of the Gutter, Pulp Pusher, Grit, Demolition, Crime Factory, All Due Respect, and in several anthologies. He's been nominated 3 times for the Derringer Awards, 3 times shortlisted for Best American Mystery Stories, selected for the Writer's Digest Year's Best Writing 2003, just narrowly lost the Anthony Award in 2013 and 14, and won the inaugural Bullet Award in June of 2011. Todd is the author now of his collection of shorts called Dirty Words, and his debut novel, which is out right now, called Hard Bound, is about to be followed up with his new novel come September or October, we'll find out for sure, called Rough Trade. I have a copy of it, published by Polis Books. It's excellent. Meet Todd Robinson. Hey, Todd, welcome to Authors on the Air.
Well, thank you for having me. And the release date of Rough Trade is actually August 9th.
August 9th. Okay, I knew it was coming up. And, you know, I lose release dates in my brain as often as I lose thoughts, too, and words and everything else. So, sorry I couldn't keep up with that. But no matter.
No, that's fine. I can't keep track of myself.
Yeah. So, you and I talked about when we decided you wanted to come on the show, I was saying I'm looking for writer dads with creative children, and I knew that you have a son. And what I didn't know was how creative he is, especially because he's a youngster. I mean, this is a kid who's playing with Legos still, right? And I guess older kids do too, but to me, Legos were always for younger kids. So for this month, for Father's Day, I want you to tell me about your son, just his first name and his age, and tell me what he is creative with or in.
Well, his name is Sam. He is 6 years old. He's going to be 7 in September. He's in the first grade. And he is an immense, immense storyteller.
Really?
It's amazing. He's kind of, every time we're on the train together, he just says, Daddy, I want to tell stories. And we go back and forth. And he says, Daddy, you tell me a story. And he'll tell me where he wants it set. And I'll just improvise a story for him. And then I'll say, yeah. And then I'll say, Daddy, let me tell you a story. And he'll let me give him a setting. And he'll roll from there. He has a series that he writes. And his mother and I actually have written these out with him. And it's called The Hiding Things Boys. And it's a sort of adventurous superhero team where he is the leader, of course. And 3 of his friends is in the neighborhood, Noah, Tendon, and Lucas, are also team members, and they go on adventures. And he's written 18 of these books.
You're kidding me. Do you have them bound for him? Because, you know, you can have kids' books bound for them.
Yes, we haven't had them bound. We do print them out. We do, you know, very basic illustrations, which he colors, but he just recites the story, and we try to type it down as best as we can. And then we kind of bind it ourselves. We just sort of, you know, print it out and fold it up and staple it and keep them in a pile.
I love this. How long has he been doing this?
For about 2 years, I'd say.
Really?
So since he was 4.
Now, did Sam learn to read pretty quickly, or was he read to all the time that he became interested in storytelling?
He's read to nightly. Every night he gets a story before bed.
And what kind of stories does he like you to tell? Does he like you to make up stories, or does he want you to read from a book so he can follow along?
Mostly he likes us to create stories on the fly. And they mostly involve the Hiding Things boys. That's his go-to genre. He likes the adventure stories that involve him and his friends.
Sure.
As far as reading to him is concerned, it's a really wide swath. I mean, we just finished our first Hardy Boys book, which I had read to him. He likes a series called Stick Dog. Anything by Mo Willems. The Mo Willems collection has been instrumental in teaching him to read. They're fantastic books for kids.
Wow.
Because they're repetitive without ever being boring or feeling like that they're forcing reading into a child. It's just very conversational and repeating back and forth the conversations.
Unlike what we were forced to read, you know, I remember having to see Jane Run and, you know, or see Spot or something like that. The most unoriginal, non-creative books you could ever imagine. I guess they were good for learning the words, but there certainly didn't inspire any type of imagination in a kid,
Not in the slightest. I mean, the Mo Willems books, any parent who's listening to this, if you don't know the Mo Willems books, particularly my favorites, which are the Elephant and Piggy series, they're going to be spoken in the same sentence as Dr. Seuss in the next 20 years. They're phenomenal, phenomenal books, and I enjoy them as much as he does. And my heart was just broken recently. I had a Mo Willems exhibit here in New York at the New York Historical Society that Sam and I went to, which was fantastic for him, because beyond even seeing all the characters and original artwork from the books, it details the process from step one of creating a book into publishing a book. And so we got to see that entire process laid out for him. And it broke my heart at the end of the exhibit when it announced that the final Elephant and Piggy book would be coming out in May, which it just did. So he's actually closing the series. I believe it was after 20 books.
Wow. So when did you realize that your son was probably going to want these little stories that he created put into books? When did you decide to start doing that? Because I think it's a brilliant thing to do for that parents do that. Imagine when he becomes a very famous New York Times bestselling author, and you're sitting back in your rocking chair thinking, I still got this original book that he wrote.
Well, his first one, it's funny because it's touching for me. Because when I was around his age, I attempted to write my first Hardy Boys book. And, you know, knowing nothing about copyright infringement or storytelling, it wasn't very good.
Sure.
But one day I just came home, and he and his mother had sat and had written a Curious George book for himself. He'd been reading a lot of the Curious George books at that time, and he came up with an original idea, and it was Curious George Goes to the Laundromat. And he, you know, and Allison, his mother, said that he just started telling the story and she started writing it, but he captured the style of the Curious George books perfectly. And I just read through it, and it was very, very similar storytelling style to the Curious George books.
Hmm.
And that was sort of the start of it. And then he created his own characters out of himself and his friends. And rolled from there.
It's interesting to me because everything that I hear about children who read and write very early on in their life, readers always become leaders. And whether or not a child decides to stay on the humanities side or the softer side of an education, for example, English and the arts and all those things, even if that child decides to go into a left brain thinking field, readers will always be ahead of the class. That's the best gift you can give your kid. Don't you agree?
I would hope so. I would hope so, because that's the primary gift that I have to offer him.
Right.
And I think that reading a wide swath of different things can not only give someone a deeper understanding of people around them that they might not necessarily be a part of their daily lives, but also a greater empathy towards the plights of others, because that's what you see in stories. You're experiencing the difficulties in the lives of people who are unlike your own. And I think that
I'm sorry,
go
ahead, continue. No, I meant to ask you, does Sam know that Daddy is a writer?
Yes.
Does he understand what that means? He understands
he does a little bit because, well, his mother also runs a bookstore as well.
Ah.
So he has been surrounded by books and writing since birth. And I remember when we did the launch for the Hard Mountain Mysterious Bookshop, and that was 3.5 years ago, when he was little more than 3 years old, he walked into the store and saw the pile of my books on the table, and his eyes just went wide, and he just turned around and said, "These books are all mine." I said, "Well, actually, no." I'm like, "Thank you, buddy, but these are to sell." He just looked at them and he's fascinated, like I said, now with the process after the exhibit, and he says he wants his books to be able for people to buy in Mommy's bookstore. So he understands
a little bit
of the idea of the process.
Are you going to, as he grows, I'm sure you're going to, to encourage him to continue to read and write. When he gets a little bit older, are you going to share with him that a writer's life is not necessarily an easy one, but can be a profoundly fulfilling life?
I think he's just going to see that growing up as my son. I don't think I'm going to have to educate him in any aspect of that. I think he's just going to experience it firsthand.
Has he met other authors besides you? Does he know who your author friends are?
Yes. He doesn't know them necessarily as authors.
Uh-huh.
Rob Hart, for instance, he knows as Baby
sure.
Abby's daddy.
Right.
Rob has a beautiful baby girl. And the first time met Abby, Sam said, "Daddy, can I read her a story?" And
how
she
lovely.
Was 3-4 months old. And so I have some photographs of Rob's wife, Amanda, sitting at our table, and Sam standing next to her and Abby with an elephant and picky book, just reading a story to Abby. That was his first instinct and his first thing that he wanted to do when he met the baby.
He gets so much pleasure out of it himself, he wanted to share.
Exactly.
How wonderful.
Exactly.
Well, you get the father of the night button because I think that's amazing to have a child who's so invested in writing and reading. Let me ask you, do you think that it's hereditary? Do you think it's the environment? Is it a little of both that
people have
creative children?
I think it just comes as a matter of being part of that environment. Because children see what their parents are doing, and there's an automatic curiosity in there. And I 100% believe that if a child does not see a parent reading, the child will not have an interest in reading. Because in watching their parent doing that, they're seeing a value towards the activity. And I have some
very close family
members who are not readers, and their children are not readers, and they don't understand or have a passion for what I see as the joy of reading.
Right.
And it's something that is completely alien to me. And I remember my father reading. That's one of the things. And then I would read with him. I mean, my experience was very unique as well in that sense. My father was a teacher as well. He was an English teacher. And we grew up in a not so palatable area when I was very young in Fall River,
mm-hmm.
Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't a lot of children that I was allowed to play with because of some questionable family and questionable activities amongst those families. And I have a sister who was a couple years older than I who would come home from school, and I would learn her lessons with her. It became a game for me. So I learned to read at an exceptionally early age. I had a fifth grade reading level when I was tested for kindergarten.
Wow.
So I've just always been a very, very passionate reader. I didn't have any type of real formal education in writing or creative writing. It's just that I read so much. I just developed just a sense for storytelling, I suppose.
Sure, you
and
get
I've
it from
Osmosis.
I
well.
I think that if you are that avid a reader, it comes to you. You recognize the way story is told, and you know, you just, a lot of it's intuitive, I believe. With some people, a lot of it is intuitive. You don't necessarily have to have an MFA or even, you know, a BA in creative writing or English or anything else, because most authors, I don't believe, do. You know, as witnessed by the fact that...
Most of the ones that I like, though.
Yeah, I mean, who, you know, you have doctors and lawyers who have their degrees who are writing books and enjoying it much more than what, you know, what they trained for. So yes,
yeah.
I understand that and I agree with it. Yeah.
But I also feel, I mean, everyone's experiences are different on how they landed there. I mean, I wound up being a bit of a perfect storm because I work in the bar industry as well, which is one of the last remaining storytelling oral tradition spots in our culture.
It
people
really
just
is.
Naturally like telling their stories at the bar. And so, you know, I know I've been lucky enough to be surrounded by all of these characters and stories over the course of my adult life and in my jobby job that I could draw from and really take from their stories as well.
Interesting, because I do believe that that is a really great place to get story. Also, if you live in the South, generational storytelling out on the front, the wraparound porch, is another really good place for storytelling. A lot of Southern writers get that from just generations of storytelling. That's how we told history. I think that's how many Southern families told of generations of family. That's how they, you know, your family history is there. And that was entertainment, too. You didn't, you know... You weren't supposed to be sitting in a house watching a TV. You were supposed to be with family and eating and, you know, playing in the front yard. And if you were old enough and interested enough, then you would be telling stories. You'd be creating stories even.
Absolutely.
You know, there's a very rich there's such a rich history of storytelling that comes nowhere near a college. And that's as it should be, I think. You know, that's
and
as
the
it should be.
Northeast variation. That I grew up with, you know, being coastal in Fall River and right by New Bedford, which has a huge whaling history, is the old fishtail. That's the New England variation on the southern porch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Todd, I want to kind of move a little bit forward and talk to you about Thug Lick magazine. You really were kind of a trailblazer in doing this. Thug Lit was well known and well loved by many, 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 both readers and writers. You have had some of the best on incorporated into that magazine, that online magazine. Can you please give me the background and how you decided to start Thug Lit?
Well, I got pissed off, which has always been a great motivator for me. When I really
Whatever
entered
works,
into the
right?
genre. Yeah, it's great fuel. nobody was publishing the kind of fiction that A, I wanted to read, and B, that I was writing.
Right.
And the only people who were was an online magazine called Plots with Guns, and they had just shuttered for the first time. They've come and gone a few times since, but they had shuttered for the first time, and I looked around and went, there's no one publishing the kind of stuff that I like. And there was a short story Q&A panel at BoucherCon featuring, you know, some writers and editors from the old standbys, the Ellery Queen and Alfred Hitchcock.
Right.
And I just, you know, I posited the question of, like, you know, what are you doing to bring newer audiences with a different sensibility into your magazine? Because by your guidelines, if I'm writing a modern crime story, and at the time I was 2005, I said, if I've got a crackhead getting beaten with a pipe, the harshest language you allowed me to use is "oh fudge." I'm like, that's not realistic or true storytelling to the age we're currently living in.
Right.
And they just sort of got haughty about being questioned, first of all, because they were so accustomed to just being the game in town that it finally landed on, well, if you don't like it, start your own magazine. You know, well, fine, I will. And I did.
And
it was, you know, an 11-year run with a couple of years missing in the middle when my son was born and nobody had time to do that shit.
Sure.
And that was it. And I'm still closing up the final quote-unquote issue, which is actually going to be released as a final anthology rather than a numbered issue. Hoping to have that available within the next week and a half. But I will admit to enjoying the time off a little bit more than I probably should be. And, you know, like they say about kids finishing up their high school education, I've got a little bit of senioritis about it. I'm like, ah, I'll get it done.
Yeah, I understand.
I've been too busy enjoying myself.
Well, you know, it's a really interesting phenomenon with this. Like, Pitts likes to call it the neo-noir crime fiction crowd. It seems like nobody's just doing one thing. You know, Pitts is doing Out of the Gutter and Gutter Books, and he's also now doing Skid Row Chatter on this network. And, you know, like Angel Cologne, who's doing a bunch of different things, and Michael Poole and Alex DeGuerre. Everybody's doing a bunch of different things, and I really like that. You know, I love Shotgun Honey. I think that's one of the best magazines out there. I like Out of the Gutter. I like almost all of them. I wish that I had, and of course, you know, all due respect, I love them. I wish that I had more time to spend, because I still am learning about the neo-noir crime fiction writers, the new crime fiction writers. The old ones, you know, I mean, I know those guys. I've been reading all my life. I love books. And, you know, so I know the old guys. I remember pulp. Like when Will Vahara was on and we were talking about pulp, I remember all of those magazines and books and, you know, so it's great. It's wonderful. But I'm behind the times now on who all of the authors are, which is why this network created Noir on the Radio after seeing all the Noir at the Bar stuff. And, you know, kind of opened it up and said, here, you guys, you get to go and, you know, whoever wants to be the host can be the host of the show, and you can put on whatever you want. For example, like Greg Barth is doing one on the 21st, next Tuesday. He's doing a Dames in the Dark show. You know, I want to do, a Men of Crime thing, you know, a Men of Dark Crime night, too. And it gets other authors in to host. I can't do it. I just don't know that much about it. I don't know who the right people to tap are, but I'm learning. I have a lot of really great books on my shelves now. So it's really a lot of fun. So now that you're folding up Thuglit, and who knows, you may change your mind when Sam is older and you're saying, he's doing his own books now. The kid's more successful. He can support me. I'll open another Thuglit or something similar to it. You know, you never know. But it's interesting to me that your progression into the full-blown novel has been in baby steps almost, because you started with writing Flash and essays and shorts, and then went into doing shorts and entries into anthologies. So your first collection of short stories was Dirty Words, correct?
Yeah.
And when did you publish that one, and how did you decide to publish a collection of shorts?
Well, that was – oh, Jesus, when the hell did I publish that? What year is it now? that was right
before – let's see if I can find it. Let's see if I can find it in your Dirty Words is in 2012, June of 2012.
Yes, I was going to
say
4 years ago,
exactly. 4-year anniversary, right. Yeah.
That was right before I had decided to bring back the magazine, because I wanted to test the waters, because for the first time, we were strictly online from 2005 to 2010. But at that point, ebooks and print on demand became viable. Print on demand books look as good as traditionally published books. And
or
the Kindle
better.
Was becoming a thing.
Quite honestly.
Yeah, in some cases, yeah. And I went, you know what? There's an opportunity here, A, to potentially turn this into some sort of small business, and B, finally be able to pay the fucking writers, which I was never able to do before, because we generated no income. It was costing me $400 an issue to produce back when it was online, just strictly out of, you know, even just like paper and ink costs for my printer. And I would give the writers a T-shirt for the magazine if we published them. And I wanted to set up a system where the writers could deservedly at least earn enough money to buy a decent bottle of whiskey or something. which sure. I think is about where we max out, is a decent bottle of whiskey. It's all we can ever afford. And so I put together my own short story collection just to test the waters, almost like a beta run for what would become the magazine, just figure out how to format it correctly, figure out what kind of nightmare that was going to be. When you're writing a bunch of short stories, you have them published and they just sit around not doing anything for a while. I figured, let me just throw them out there in a collection. And then, and also at that point, the novel, The Hard Bounce, was dead in the water. It was dead in the water. I mean, I finished the first draft of that book in 2002.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was a 10-year process to get it finally published. Nobody wanted the book. And I went through 5 agents and 3 publishers. One publisher went under before the book came out. Another publisher was a straight-up scam. Another publisher didn't have the money that they told me they would have and put me through back-and-forth edits because they didn't have the money to pay me upon completion. And it was just a 10-year disaster. Ken Bruin once referred to me as a walking cautionary tale of the writing business.
Wow,
and he wasn't wrong. But I never had an opportunity to really work on another book because every time one opportunity would fall through, another one would rear its head, and that always entailed new edits and new this and new that. But looking back,
you were chasing
now,
your tail. You were chasing your tail without too much of a break. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it never stopped. Never stopped.
Because life goes on in the meantime.
10 years now. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I still got to work my work and do what I have to do.
And
at that point, begin raising a child. But those 10 years were so invaluable to me as far as figuring out how I needed to tell a story. What wound up being the published novel is very different from what I started submitting in 2002. And I'm very, very grateful for those years of failure because it enabled me to fine-tune what I was doing in a way that I wouldn't have had the opportunity to otherwise.
Well, it's the only teacher you have that counts is failure.
And that's also why the magazine was so invaluable to me as well, because I would see there was nothing that taught me more about my own flaws than seeing the flaws in others' writing. Because when you read someone's fantastic writing, you just go, wow, that's great. Then that's what they do. But when you see flaws in someone's writing and recognize that you also share those flaws, it gives you pause and go, well, wait a minute. I do the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Well, you know, that's why there's a guy who used to podcast on this network. His name is Stephen Campbell. He has an absolutely fantastic show called The Author Biz. And he's like, you know, he's like NPR. I realized a long time ago that I'm like Funny Farm compared to him. I mean, the students surpass the teacher many times over, and I can happily look back and say, it's okay. You know, I may have kind of a slap-together show, which it really isn't, as you know. But I also have over 2,000 author interviews under my belt, and I get to talk to the best of the best. Every person that comes on my show, I am certain they are the best of the best. Every single one.
Well, you're right in my case.
I know that. Well, you've told me that, Todd.
Well.
You've told me that. And I believe you. So, you know, I have no reason. You've never lied
myself
to me before.
In the hopes that someday I'll believe it. I mean, by my own admission, I refer to my style of writing as idiot noir.
Yeah, but, you know, if you're enjoying yourself and people are enjoying your work, which they obviously are, you have a very excellent reputation in this little crime fiction community that is out there and growing all the time. I know people talk about, you know, I'm going to talk to Todd about this. I want to see what Todd likes it. You know, what does he think about this and that? So you know, maybe your 10 years of failure were really building you up to be the professional advice giver that you are now in the writing field in crime fiction. So that's really nice.
I take immense pride in that. I take immense pride in that. Not only the fact that people think my opinion is worth a flying time, but if I can help another writer at any freaking point avoid the pratfalls that I have done myself, then that's part of the reason I'm here. It's like I said before, it's like, help me help you. Tell me what
right.
you need, tell me what your problems are, because I probably have a point of reference for that in my history of failure.
Because you may have done it, right.
Because
right.
not only have I done it, you know, without throwing names out, because that's not how I roll, there's a young writer who has sort of got himself a bit of a reputation for brashness.
Okay.
And I talk to the writers who discuss this, and I say, be patient with them, because I had the same rep. And all that is a desperate need to be taken seriously when your career hasn't provided you that opportunity yet.
Sure. You're finding your way. You gotta find your own place in your little community there, whatever it happens.
Yeah, and sometimes
that
results in chest puffing.
Right.
Because and I'm not proud of it, and I learned from it, and I learned, don't drink so much at conventions out of nerves.
Right.
That's a big one for me. Stop after the first bottle of whiskey before you talk too much shit.
Right.
But I understand even the mistakes within personality clashes, because I've done those too. I've done all of them, and I'm continuing to make mistakes.
But don't you agree, though, that the author community, whichever it is, whatever genre fiction community it is, or as a whole, is a very forgiving and a very collegial group of human beings. I don't think I know anyone who's not said, I'll offer whatever advice I have. If someone wants
yes.
me to help them, I'm going to help them. Or we'll go up and say, hey, do you need some help? Here I am. Here's my number. Call me. I think everyone wants everyone else to succeed because it raises
absolutely.
The level. It raises the level of the genre, doesn't it?
Rising tide lifts all boats.
Yep.
That's one of my favorite go-to phrases. The rising tide lifts all
yeah.
boats. And
absolutely.
I remember the first time an author asked me to blurb their book. That blew my mind.
Like,
really? Me? Yeah. I was like, okay. That blew my mind. That was
somebody
such...
asked me, and I said, go talk to a real person. I'm just talking head on a radio show, you know. I know a lot of people, but that's a marvelous thing, isn't it?
I work 55 hours a week in bars to supplement my writing habit. I'm certainly, no gigantic success in terms of sales are concerned. So the idea that someone saw value in putting my name anywhere on their cover and not as a detriment blew me away, and I was so humbled by that.
I've seen your name on cover, so I know that it is a valuable commodity to them, so good on you for getting that reputation.
It's flattering. Every time.
But here's the thing. I think you have a reputation for being honest. Whether your delivery system is off or on doesn't necessarily matter. I think that, because I know you can be rough and all that, but I think you are, I think you're fairly measured in your response to things, and you're always honest, because what good are you as a writer friend to another writer if you're not honest?
I try to feel that way about
bridges,
my own writing as well.
Yeah, well,
sometimes
that's the hardest damn thing.
Yeah. And then, but again, if nothing else, it's like if you're not telling the truth in your writing, then you're just piling up a series of lies, and it reads as that. And sometimes that personal morality
sure.
can be too much, but
sure.
at least it's honest. I do also have the reputation for being harsh at times, but I think of it more or less as being, I'm going to be straight with you.
Right.
Because in beating around the bush, I'm not doing anybody any favors. Particularly not writers. I had a bunch of writers at the bar the other day, and they were all laughing because they'd all been recently rejected by the magazine. And I said, if I blindly accept you because you're my friend, I'm doing you no fucking favors. Because the story you send me doesn't live up to our standard. And it doesn't live up to a standard that I know you're capable of. So if I accept your bullshit story, you're going to think that that's the way to go. And I'm not doing you that favor.
Right. Because it's not really a favor. It's not a favor.
It's not. It's going to hurt them in the long run.
I want to talk.
One of my favorites was another writer who was a friend of mine.
I'm sorry.
I had rejected a story of his, and he, and again, I don't have the time to give everyone a personal critique, but it was immediately picked up in another magazine, and he came into the bar because he's local as well, and everyone comes into the bar where I'm working because that's half the time the only way they see me. And he just sort of sat down and was like, well, this magazine picked it up. He's like, what did you think the problem with it was? And I laid it down point for point what my problem with his story was. And with every point, his face dropped a little bit more. Until finally he went, oh, shit, you're right. But now that story exists in that form. Instead of trying to figure out what could possibly be wrong with the story and why it had warranted a rejection,
right,
he sent it to a magazine who probably in all likelihood accepted it because he was a fairly well-known name within our little community. And that happens a lot, too.
So, well, at least you weren't compromising what your standards were, and that's important. And, you know.
Never did.
And that's as it should be. I want to move on a little bit because I want to talk to you about your two full-length novels. Your debut novel, The Hardbound, is out and available. Give listeners the elevator pitch, the short elevator pitch. Tell us about Hardbound.
The elevator pitch on that, which again, I just generally refer to my style with these characters as idiot noir, which are a bunch of dumb people doing dumb things and trying to punch their way out of it until finally either they have to change their tactics out of necessity or stupidity. Two bouncers named Boo and Junior, who work at a rock and roll club in Boston, that find themselves charged with the task of finding a 14-year-old runaway for a various number of reasons, some of which are professional, some of which are personal. And that is the first novel.
Okay. So that runaway is Cassandra, right?
That is the French version, yes. It's called Cassandra in France.
Okay. Because you have also this is where I was leading. Because I love the picture of you that I posted with you sitting at the desk with your hands on your cheeks. And the cover looked like it's hot pink. It may have been red. I'm not sure. But, you know, I posted it in the event for this particular podcast night.
Yeah.
I remember following you on Facebook when you were in France. The tablecloths looked pink. I don't know if they were red, though. You sold out of every single one of your books, didn't you?
In less than 2 days.
And this was like a 4-day event or something, I think you told me.
Yeah, it was I was there for 4 days. It was a three and a half day event.
3.5-day event. In 2 days,
there,
everything
there were
was gone.
Six more hours in that last day, and there were no books left.
It just is amazing. And you could see all the people behind you in one of the pictures, the one I happened to use for the promotion, where people are still signing and there's, readers are going through and they're looking at everything. And you're just sitting there thinking, oh, well, I have nothing left. And then you talked about people recognizing you and pointing and saying, Cassandra, meaning the book, right?
Yeah.
How fun was that? Do you want to go back and do it again?
I am going back, hopefully in early 2017. My French publisher, Gallmeister, has picked up the rights to Rough Trade, the second Boo and Junior novel, and they verbally committed to the third novel, which I don't have in the United States yet.
Interesting.
Which I'm currently working on now.
Are they going to be your series characters, do you think? And if they
absolutely.
will you write a standalone also?
I'm working on a standalone. I just started a standalone that I'm writing concurrently with the third Boo and Junior book.
How fun is that?
It's stretching
that?
For me. You know, I've got the best agent in the world, Stacia Decker, who God bless this woman's patience with me. I've sort of been her loose cannon for a number of years, and God bless her, they haven't made any money off of anything I've done. But she's stuck by me. Her advice is invaluable. And she puts me to task when it's time to put me to task. She has no bullshit about where I stand. And at one point, she's like, you know, I would like to see you maybe try something a little more literary. And I just sort of was like, I really love writing the Boo and Junior books because these characters are so dear to me and close to me Right. And there's such a reflection of a life that I lived, that it's the easiest thing in the world for me to write. And then when I write it, it's like I'm visiting old friends. And she just sort of nodded and said, yeah, I'm sure it's the easiest thing for you to write. I was like, well, maybe it's time to challenge yourself. And I just kind of stopped like, oh, shit, she's right.
Wow.
And so I bandied around
a couple of... Wow, so she told you a hard truth, too.
Oh, straight up.
She told you a hard truth, too.
I experiment in those things with my short stories. My short stories have had a tendency over the last few years to get progressively darker, progressively more, I don't know, if what literary means at this point with regards to what I'm writing. But, I find myself unable to maintain a dark tone for too long in my own longer fiction. The inevitable smartass inside of me worms its way to the surface. But I'm going to see what happens with the standalone. It might be an utter failure, but it's going to be fun trying. And
well,
worst case scenario,
my,
and then I got the third Thorne Jr. book.
You're writing genre fiction, and so anything that's not genre fiction to me is literary fiction, and I'm so not a good reader of that. As many books as I consume, and you know how many books I read, I'm not a huge fan of literary fiction either, or anything historical, and I get tons of it from publishers all the time. I get like 20 books a week from publishers, and sometimes up to 50. And some of the stuff is, I'm thinking, I don't want to read how you met and fell in love in World War One, and then we're separated, and then 60 years later we're back together after this horrible war, and somebody was thought was dead came back, and I just can't. It doesn't do a freaking thing for me, Todd. So
yeah.
I leave the literary fiction aside. I'd rather read genre anyway. I was looking in your reviews. First of all, I want to ask you, how important are reviews to you personally, not professionally?
It depends on the review.
I want to congratulate you. Hold on one second. I want to congratulate you on having your one-star cherry pop. And so
yeah.
I noticed that you have one-star review. So congratulations, because every author needs to have his one-star cherry pop. Yours was done.
Yeah.
Everything else was brilliant. Everybody loved your book. They have written absolutely glowing reports about this book.
Which, again, this was a book nobody wanted.
Right.
Nobody. And
well, you obviously did it right.
Back, I don't know what I did, but I'm happy. I mean, I can't express how happy I'm with the response. And not only that, but the response in France as well. That blows me away, because I at the very least here, I built up something of a reputation and a name recognition through the magazine.
Sure.
Over in France, they don't know me from a friggin' hole in the wall. And the response has been equal, if not greater, overseas.
But you know why, and I think I have a handle kind of on why it is, because, obviously noir was a French word when we had noir film and everything else. It was that style of film and style of writing that was coined by the French. And I think because they love noir film so much, they love noir crime fiction too. It doesn't surprise me that you are popular. It's very different.
The sensibility
is
so different. And the same reason that American publishers have crapped on me for 10 years, and I mean crapped on me, is because I'm trying to do something different. I just had a major publisher, two different editors, say they loved the book, but it was too niche. Where over in France, their attitude is, oh, you wrote something different. That's fantastic.
Right. Exactly. There's a huge difference in the way reading is viewed and story is viewed in Europe, and especially in those reading countries, in England, France, Germany, where there's so many readers like that, that it's amazing. And good for you for doing well overseas and locking it in France. I'm sure that when Rough Trade comes out, and as I say, I have the copy that'll be out in the beginning of August, folks, but I got that wrong. So, a little bit more than a month away, 6 weeks away. And I will be reviewing, by the way.
I think I would be remiss. The reason I even have this in no small degree is thanks to Benjamin Whitmer.
Yeah, Ben's great.
Because the same publisher had picked up Pike and Cry Father, And one of the things that this publisher does that I think is so wonderful is they find new books by asking their current writers, who do you think we should read? And Ben Whitmer recommended my novel to them. And I always, I mean, this publisher traditionally, they really like rural sensibilities. You know, that's
well,
why they're doing Steve
you
Nettle.
You have to admit, you have to admit, though, that Cry Father is a brilliant, brilliant piece of writing.
Ben is stunning. He's a stunning writer.
He's a
stunning. There's no getting about that. But like I said, I wouldn't be enjoying what I'm enjoying right now with that success overseas without Ben Whitmer first just suggesting my book to them. Because I fell through a crack.
That's the writing community. But that's the writing community. You know,
absolutely.
Okay, it worked for me. Let's see if it's going to work for you, too. I got lucky. I want you to get lucky, too. I can't imagine you not paying it forward also. So,
well, that just happened last week. There's a writer who sent me a message on Facebook. And this writer is, in my opinion, in a much more secure place in his career than I am, asking me about my French publisher. And it's like, what was your experience? I said, I don't want to oversell it, but it was the greatest experience I've ever had in publishing. So it was fantastic. And he asked for contact information. I gave it all to him. Like, whatever you need, here you go. And then he says, I owe you a steak. And I'm like, you don't owe me a damn thing. Because if we're not looking out for each other, who is?
Pay it forward. Right. You just pay it forward to the next guy.
But it also takes no effort for me to share the information that I have with another writer.
Yeah, exactly.
I am not in competition with any other writer.
No,
I'm
you're
in competition
not. You're
with
in
myself.
Competition with yourself. Absolutely. For you to make the next book better. So here's my question to you, because then I want to move on to something else. When you look back at the first story that you wrote, whether it was a short or, an essay, anything like that, and you look at the most recent thing that you've done and are writing on right now, what do you see in yourself? What have you learned?
Wow, that is a good question. There's a part of me that looks at some of my earliest stuff because I really wrote, I know what my first story was. And like I said before, I wrote it because I was pissed off. I wrote it just to get some venom out of my system towards a friend of mine who had stolen a bunch of money from me. So I decided to kill him in fiction. And I'm trying to remember now. I don't remember if that was the first one I wrote or if that was my first published story. But either way, in some ways, I don't think I'm as good as I was. I think I have a better idea of what's come before me in trying to avoid cliche or trying to avoid, just to give it a sense of originality.
Maybe it's you're not as innocent about writing and publishing as you were, because I don't think you were probably better than you are now. I think
I was a more instinctive writer then.
And
I think I was a more instinctive writer.
You may have been with your storytelling. You may have been, but I bet you that that's okay that you're not, because if it becomes more fluid for you, that's makes you even a better writer.
Yeah, I think that's up to debate, because I think there were certain things in my earlier writing that instinct served me well, and there are things that I'm writing today that refinement serves me well. So
absolutely.
I mean, they're not. I don't think they're terribly different on the surface. Like I said, they've gotten progressively darker.
Well, yeah, and you're finding your voice as well, Todd. You are finding, where you're going to end up in your novel writing experiences, because certainly it's easy to do flash or essay or shorts and change mood. But I think as your novel writing experience becomes richer and more varied, maybe that's the way your voice is intended to be, a much darker voice when you're writing. Who knows?
I'm not sure.
You know?
I'm not sure. Like I
it
said, the short
change.
Form and the long
it
form.
It may change. It
yeah.
may change.
And that's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
There's a great
yeah.
Charlie Mingus quote that I have on a postcard, and it just says, my music is always changing because I am always changing as a person.
There you go. Well, you know,
and that's how I feel about my
book
writing.
And music, our book and music tastes do change. We get, once we're settled into our life and we're a little bit more comfortable, it's a little bit more steady. But in the beginning, you know, I look at myself at when I was 20, I look at myself when I'm 40, and I look at myself where I am right now. And, you know, the biggest difference was between 20 and 40, not between 40 and my current age. So, you know, I think it's like that for writing too. We have a little bit of time left, just about 5 minutes. So I want to ask your opinion. In noir crime fiction and dark crime fiction, who are you looking at as being some of the best right now?
That is a very difficult question because my novel reading took a real hit during the magazine. I found myself reading the equivalent of 8 books a month worth of short stories.
Right.
And just imagine that for a second, reading 8 books a month worth of short stories, and 7 of those weren't quite good enough.
Right.
That was where I found myself for the last year and a half, which actually led to part of the decision to end the magazine, was I didn't want to read some good shit for a change.
Let's say I ask you for 5 authors, and it doesn't mean that they're the best out there, but off the top of your head, I say, give me 5 authors whose books I should go and buy. Who are you going to tell me?
Guys that I'm consistently looking forward to, I can just say that. Rob Hart.
Okay. Without a doubt.
Yeah. Rob as well, when you talk about originality, I said, I've had conversation after conversation with writers that get angry because everything that Rob comes out with short story wise is such a fresh take on something. And everyone,
but even his series is still fresh. I think his
and
writing
he's changing
has
it with every book.
Year
That's
year.
What's fascinating.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. I think the best title of a book ever written was called New Yorked. I don't think there was ever a title of a book any better than that. New York is the best name I've ever heard for a book. However, when City of Rose came out and I was reading that book, I thought it's a better written book than New Yorked was. I thought he tightened up his writing. The story was more cohesive. It was exciting, and you just knew what was going to happen. It was brilliant, and honestly, I think Rob's one of the best writers out there. Who else would you recommend?
He's killing it. Ben
off
Whitmer,
the top
obviously.
Of your head.
Ben Whitmer.
I'm sorry,
can't
Ben
wait
Whitmer.
To see what he does next.
Yeah.
I cannot wait for the new Donald Ray Pollock to come out.
Okay.
So excited for the new Donald Ray Pollock because, again, he's the guy who writes from a pure sense. A pure sense, almost like Harry Cruz did in his early days. Just fantastic stuff. Where Ben Whitmer, you know, teeters on that literary sense, but it's a pure literary sense.
He does. But he's so brilliant. He's such a brilliant writer, though. His intelligence just screams through every page. It's so nuanced in some ways and so subtle, but it just grabs you by the throat and will not let you go. I love the way Benjamin Whitmer writes.
They both in very different senses. They echo Harry Cruz, who is one of my favorite writers of all time.
And also Brian Panowich. I love how Brian Panowich writes, too.
Yes,
I thought Bull Mountain was just a majestic book. Majestic.
Yep.
Truly.
Absolutely.
And as a matter of fact, he's on tour next week. So who else would you recommend?
The novel's not out yet, but, man, I'm holding my breath for it. Jordan Harper.
I've read some of his shorts and all. I like them. I'm anxious to talk to him. I'd like to hear him on Noir on the Radio. Would you care to sit in and be a guest host one night and interview Jordan and maybe Ben and a couple other people?
Possibly. I'm suffering a terrible time crunch in my current personal predicament.
You can.
I took a night off of work to do this.
Well, you don't have to take a night off. You can do a pre-record, and then we'll go ahead and put it up. I'll talk to you about it, okay?
We can discuss that, but in theory, yes, I would love to do that.
Okay, great. We'll talk about that.
Jordan is a very good writer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jordan is one of those rare writers, along with Rob Hart. I've never rejected a story of theirs. Every story they send me, I accept it. They have a 0% rejection rate from Thuglit.
I'll tell you what, you need to keep an eye on a young lady named Emily Moore. Her father, Warren Moore, as you know, Emily writes, read a piece of flash horror last night on the radio for me. She's 19 years old and she's brilliant. Brilliant. I guarantee you, you're going to hear more about her. I'm going to have her come on and be a guest host with me. At 19, she's been writing all her life. And
well, she's 19
read,
old. I won't curse her out. being so good at 19.
I don't think that's not an issue. We're out of time tonight, folks. Todd, as always, brilliant. Come back again because we could talk forever about this stuff. You're just a terrific guest, and I'm so glad you were here. Thank you so very much. That ends our week, but next week we continue with Father's Day celebrations. My first guest, however, in the morning on Monday is David Ivester, who is what he calls himself is an author god. He's a marketing and publicity specialist. That's for everyone who needs to know about marketing and publicity. In the evening, Raymond Benson is here. He's got a creative son who's a rock and roller. Noir on the Bar is on Tuesday. Greg Barth has four women for Dames in the Dark. On Wednesday, wow, what a lineup. And Skid Row Chatter with host Tom Pitts, Max Allen Collins, the man who wrote the graphic novel for Road to Perdition, who is the only novelist allowed to write under Mickey Spillane's name, and ever so much more. His body of work is amazing. Good on you. And then hopefully at the end of the week, I'll be talking to Joe Hart. So have a great weekend, everyone. Todd, thank you, my friend. I truly, truly appreciate it. And you and I will talk
again
soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Talk to you soon. Good night.
Good night.
All right, my friends, have a good night. Grab a good book. Go and read this weekend. Thanks for listening, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.